Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Jamie Wilson.
And I'm Ronnie Bettis.
Our mission today, well, it's straightforward. We're taking the torrent of global news and analysis from the past week, specifically looking through the lens of The Economist and boiling it down for you.
Yeah, we want to get past the noise and figure out what's really driving events as we head into November 2025.
And it's been quite a week. We've seen some high-stakes diplomacy that really only resulted in temporary fixes.
Definitely. And some absolutely stunning election results, too, like voters backing really radical austerity measures.
Plus, we're seeing these deep structural weaknesses starting to crack open in major Western cities.
All of that happening against a backdrop of, frankly, escalating global conflict.
So we're going beyond the headlines today, looking for the connections between these stories.
Right. Because when you lay out the source material like this, you start seeing patterns. You see leaders just trying to buy time, making these very transactional deals.
Hoping the big long-term problems just go away.
Pretty much. So we're here to connect those dots for you, giving you that detailed context that you often miss in the day-to-day news grind.
Absolutely. So settle in. This is our deep dive into The Economist for the week of November 1st to the 7th, 2025. Let's jump right into global geopolitics. It was dominated by that really high-stakes meeting, wasn't it?
The Trump-Xi summit,
yeah.
In Busan, South Korea.
And the U.S. president leaving the summit gave himself, what was it, a 12 out of 10?
Who did? Classic Trump self-assessment on his first face-to-face with China's leaders since January.
Okay, putting the bravado aside for a second, what did this summit actually achieve, and why is the analysis calling it just a holstering of weapons?
Well, the rhetoric was definitely bullish, wasn't it? But when you dig into the specifics, the agreements are, well, they're pretty sketchy, and crucially, temporary.
Ah, temporary.
Exactly. That phrase, holstering of weapons, is spot on because it's just a pause.
Yeah.
It's not peace. Both sides basically stepped back from what looked like an immediate, pretty nasty escalation. But they didn't touch the underlying problems, the fundamental conflict structure that's really poisoned the U.S.-China relationship for, what, 7 years now?
Right.
It was pure transactional diplomacy, maybe at its most cynical, you could say.
Okay, let's get into the specifics of that temporary truce then. What did China agree to postpone, and how big a deal were those planned actions?
China agreed to hold off on restricting exports of critical rare earths for 1 year.
Just 1 year?
Just 1 year. And these aren't just any commodities, right? These are minerals vital for defense tech, for advanced batteries, everything from fighter jets to the phone in your pocket.
So restricting them would have been a major blow.
Absolutely. It could have crippled numerous U.S. high-tech supply chains. And then on the U.S. side, America pulled back the threat of those 100% tariffs that were hanging over certain Chinese goods.
Okay.
And it also postponed the threat of export controls aimed specifically at foreign subsidiaries of blacklisted Chinese tech firms.
So basically, both leaders took their biggest, most destructive, immediate options off the table.
For exactly 12 months, yes.
So a pause on future pain, which is something, I guess. But were there any actual positive steps? Did they roll back any of the existing punitive measures?
There were a few things, yeah. Mostly designed, it seems, to reduce political heat back home for both leaders.
Okay, like what?
China agreed to start buying large amounts of American soybeans again. That's clearly aimed at easing pressure from the U.S. farm lobby on the White House. Soybeans are a huge agricultural export, and sales have been hit hard earlier this year.
Right. Always important for U.S. politics.
Definitely. And in a notable concession, the U.S. agreed to actually reduce some of its punitive tariffs. The initial 20% tariff on a big chunk of Chinese goods was lowered.
In exchange for
China, showing real measurable progress on stopping the flow of those chemical ingredients used to make fentanyl.
Which is still a massive public health crisis in the U.S.
Huge. So that was a tangible step. The president also hinted he might allow exports of some semiconductor chips to China, though pointedly not the most advanced ones.
Okay. That sounds like some, you know, incremental commercial progress. But you said the underlying relationship is still hostile. What's the evidence that this is purely tactical, built on sand, really?
The biggest piece of evidence, it's the tariff level that remains, even after that small reduction.
Okay.
Even with that cut, there's still an American tariff of 47% on Chinese goods in place.
47%. Wow.
Yeah, you really have to put that number in context.
Mm-hmm.
Before Trump, a 47% tariff, that would have been seen as unbelievably protectionist, crippling. Almost like an economic declaration of war.
So the fact that it's still there tells you?
It tells you this deal is purely tactical. It's designed to ease short-term political problems without giving up long-term leverage. And the terms are explicitly temporary, right? There's a review scheduled in a year.
Meaning the U.S. can just reimpose everything?
Exactly. The U.S. reserves the right to hit China with new tariffs, new non-tariff barriers, basically at any moment. For almost any perceived slight, the distrust is baked in.
And what about this core idea, this kind of paradox, that the whole conflict might actually be benefiting China in the long run? How is weathering this U.S. pressure actually validating Xi Jinping's big political project?
Yeah, that's one of the most fascinating takeaways from the source material, I think. For years, Xi has been pushing this massive state-funded effort to make China resilient and technologically self-reliant.
The dual circulation strategy.
That's the one. And plenty of people inside and outside China questioned if it was efficient, if it was even necessary.
But the U.S. actions.
But the sheer aggression of U.S. trade policy, the tariffs, the export bans, blacklisting companies, it's basically proven Xi right, hasn't it? It's given him the political cover and economic justification he needed.
So the pressure is forcing China down the path Xi wanted anyway.
In a way, yes. The analysis points out that China, unlike some of its neighbors, can actually withstand this kind of prolonged pressure. By forcing Chinese companies and the state to double down on advanced manufacturing, develop their own chips, control their supply chains, well, the U.S. trade war has, ironically, handed Xi a mandate.
So the distrust is still there. The conflict structure remains.
But for now, both sides seem to think that just tolerating the situation offers more short-term gain than jumping into an all-out confrontation.
That sets a pretty tense backdrop for the Asian tour that followed the summit, doesn't it?
It really does.
Let's look at the very transactional nature of the diplomacy during President Trump's, what the analysis called, his royal procession through Asia, Japan, Malaysia, South Korea. How is the U.S. security guarantee basically defined by financial extraction?
Extraction is absolutely the right word. Because these allies, Japan and South Korea especially, they rely so heavily on the U.S. For security, obviously, but also for access to the huge American market.
So they didn't have much leverage when faced with tariff threats.
Not really. Retreat was pretty much their only option. These leaders were forced, as the source puts it, to shower him with praise and gifts. And, more importantly, massive financial concessions.
It sounds less like diplomacy and more like
a protection racket, essentially. Yeah.
Can you give us the hard numbers? What did these allies have to pay effectively to get this temporary break on tariffs?
Well, South Korea, under President Lee, they finalized a deal. The U.S. agreed to lower tariffs on most South Korean imports from that punishing 25% rate set earlier this year down to 15%.
Okay, a 10-point drop. That sounds significant.
It is, but look at the price tag. South Korea had to pledge an enormous $350 billion worth of investments in the United States over the next 5 years.
$350
billion. Billion. With a B. And remember, this came after Japan, earlier in the year, had already pledged an even bigger amount, a staggering $550 billion, for similar tariff relief and security assurances.
Wow. Those are just incredible sums of effectively mandated foreign investment.
It's a massive transfer of wealth. Protectionist tariffs essentially got swapped for these mandatory high-cost investment fees.
So what's the bottom line here for these allies, particularly Japan? They're paying through the nose, but is their confidence in the U.S. security guarantee actually going up or down?
Oh, it's absolutely falling. The core message they're getting in Tokyo and Seoul is that the American commitment is shaky. Wobbly, as the analysis puts it.
So they're paying a premium just to keep the current setup from completely falling apart.
Exactly. And that lack of confidence is the main reason why these allies are now accelerating their own defense buildups. They're shifting their whole strategic outlook.
You see that with Japan's new prime minister?
Absolutely. Takeuchi-san has been very clear, vowing to strengthen Japan's defense capabilities because of the severe security environment. And notice, she didn't even try to ask Trump to lift the remaining U.S. tariffs on Japanese goods.
Didn't even ask.
No. Instead, these allies are increasingly looking at the world through an every-man-for-himself lens. They feel they have to rapidly expand their own military capabilities, partly to protect themselves, sure, but also, ironically, to maintain enough strategic value to hopefully keep America somewhat engaged in the region.
So transactional diplomacy is now reshaping strategic policy across Asia, which brings us, quite neatly actually, from the global stage right back home to some profound domestic and fiscal shockwaves hitting major economies. Starting right here in the U.S., let's turn our focus to New York City. Despite these huge, glittering symbols of financial power going up like the new J.P. Morgan Chase headquarters, the city seems to be facing this core weakness described as definancialization. Is that just jargon, or is New York genuinely losing its grip as the world's financial center?
It's not just jargon, unfortunately. Definancialization really captures this long-term structural decay. It means the financial industry, which has always been the engine of New York's economy, and crucially its tax base, is shrinking compared to other global and even domestic hubs.
Even with these giant new buildings.
Exactly. That's the paradox. You've got J.P. Morgan Chase moving into this immense, nearly 1,400-foot-tall new headquarters. A symbol of dominance, right?
Right.
Yet, the actual data underneath those gleaming towers shows the city is, well, losing its swagger.
Okay, give us the core data then. What does it show?
Well, look at the workforce share. Finance and insurance jobs in New York City have been falling for decades. It was 11.5% back in 1990. By August this year, down to just 7.7%.
Wow, that's a significant drop.
It is. And maybe more telling, look at national growth. Over the last 5 years, the U.S. created about 233,000 new finance jobs. How many did New York State get? Only about 19,000.
19,000 out of 233,000.
Yeah. It's lagging way behind competitors like Texas, Florida, North Carolina, Georgia. You even see it physically. J.P. Morgan itself, despite that new skyscraper, now employs more people in Texas than it does in New York City.
That really is a fundamental shift in market share. So what's driving this exodus? The analysis mentioned a double whammy.
Exactly. The double whammy is two things feeding each other. Really high costs for people living here, and very heavy taxes, especially for high earners and businesses.
Let's break that down. Start with the costs.
Okay, costs. These hit the talent pool hard. The median monthly rent is around $3,600. That's more than double the average in America's other 50 largest cities.
$3,600 a month median.
Yeah. And even worse, maybe, is childcare. Daycare for a baby or toddler. It averages $26,000 a year.
$26,000.
And that number has jumped 43% just since 2019. These kinds of costs make it tough for employees, obviously, but they also make employers think twice about basing large operations here, especially now with remote work being so common and other cities being so much cheaper.
Okay, so crushing costs. And then the taxes, the second part of the whammy, just pile on top.
They absolutely do, especially for local businesses. New York State's corporate income tax isn't actually the worst on its own, but then the city adds its own hefty corporate tax on top.
Right.
Plus, there's a special levy just to fund the regional transport network, the MTA. Add it all up, and the source material notes that some local businesses end up paying over 18% in local taxes alone before they even think about federal taxes.
18% just locally.
Yeah. And it's not just the rates. New York also has really exacting, often expensive local regulations. Rules about hiring, for instance. Firms can't use AI tools for hiring without getting an independent audit first to check for algorithmic bias.
So regulatory burdens add to the costs.
Hugely. Hmm. This kind of regulatory environment often pushes financial firms to slash operational costs by moving their back office functions, their middle management jobs, to cheaper, less regulated places.
Sure.
Like Dallas, Salt Lake City, even Alpharetta, Georgia, where Morgan Stanley is now surprisingly the largest private employer.
Wow, Alpharetta. Okay. But the biggest tax hit, it seems, came from that federal change back in 2017, the SALT deduction cap. We hear SALT cap thrown around a lot. Can you just briefly explain what that is and why it hit New York's tax base so hard?
Sure. SALT stands for state and local taxes. Historically, Americans could deduct the entire amount they paid in state and local taxes, income tax, property tax, whatever, from their taxable federal income.
Okay.
This basically acted as a subsidy for high-tax states like New York and California. But the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act put a cap on that deduction. Now you can only deduct $10,000.
Only $10,000, regardless of how much you actually paid.
Exactly. So imagine you're a high earner in New York City. Your combined state, city, and property taxes might easily be, say, $200,000 a year.
Right.
Suddenly, only being able to deduct $10,000 of that from your federal income, that was a massive instant tax hike for those people.
And that created a huge incentive to move.
A huge financial incentive, yeah.
Yeah.
To relocate to states with low or no income tax. Primarily Florida, Texas, Nevada. We saw big names do it. Hedge fund manager Paul Singer, investor Carl Icahn. Even former President Trump himself moved his residency to Florida in 2019.
And what was the actual hit to the city and state's finances? Was it measurable?
Oh, absolutely. The loss was substantial. New York's share of U.S. taxpayers reporting over $1 million in income definitely declined. The Citizens Budget Commission estimates this exodus cost the city and state something like $13 billion in lost income tax revenue. just based on 2022 figures.
$13 billion, that's devastating.
It is, and it's not just speculation. Goldman Sachs calculated that a full 10% of households in New York City earning over $10 million a year basically packed up an established residency somewhere else between 2018 and 2023.
10% of the top earners gone.
Yeah. Losing that high earner income is a really severe threat to New York's pretty generous municipal welfare system, which, let's be honest, has largely been funded by milking the financiers, as the analysis puts it quite bluntly.
A profound dilemma, and all this is happening just as the city looks like it's about to elect Zoran Mandani as its next mayor. A Democratic socialist, only 34, zero executive experience. How did he manage to win the primary so decisively, and what's his appeal?
Mandani's rise really reflects deep voter fatigue with the status quo, doesn't it? And huge frustration over the cost of living. He's young, 34, a declared Democratic socialist, and he absolutely trounced Andrew Cuomo, a much better known figure, in the primary.
What's his style?
His political style is kind of cheerful, but also quite strident left-wing activism. The analysis notes something interesting, his very outspoken criticism of Israel and Zionism. A few years ago, that might have been politically fatal.
But not now.
Now, it seems, many younger voters actually embrace it as proof of his authenticity, his willingness to challenge the established powers.
And his platform is certainly grabbing headlines. The source material calls it eye-wateringly expensive.
Yeah.
What are the big, potentially radical proposals?
Yeah, his core platform is all about economic relief for average New Yorkers. Free childcare, making the city's entire bus system free to ride.
Free buses, wow.
Yeah, boosting the minimum wage to an almost unheard of $30 an hour by 2030. And maybe most impactful immediately, a four-year rent freeze for the 2 million residents living in rent-stabilized apartments.
Okay, the goal is obviously to make the city more affordable. But critics are warning about a fiscal death spiral. Is that just scaremongering, or is there a real danger here? New York's been through crises before, like in the 70s.
That's a really important question. And the analysis suggests this time is different, mainly because the wealthy are just so much more mobile today than they were in the 1970s.
How does the death spiral mechanism work then?
It works like this. Mandani's proposals are basically unfunded. They'd require huge tax hikes on the wealthy.
Right.
But the city's remaining high earners, they're already feeling squeezed by the salt cap, maybe thinking about leaving anyway. If taxes go up even further, that just accelerates their departure.
Crinking the tax base even more.
Exactly. Which then requires more tax hikes or service cuts, which drives more people out. You see the spiral.
And what about things like the rent freeze? Short-term relief, maybe, but long-term consequences.
Definitely. A four-year rent freeze sounds good to tenants, but it has terrible long-term economic effects. It kills any incentive to build new housing. It discourages landlords from even maintaining the properties they have. So over time, it actually worsens the housing crisis for everyone not in a rent-stabilized unit.
And free buses, the minimum wage?
Free buses often end up becoming bad buses, lower quality, less efficient, and a $30 minimum wage. That would almost certainly scare off many mid-sized employers who are already looking at lower-cost cities. Plus, the analysis notes, Mandani doesn't really have a plan for creating new high-paying jobs to replace the finance ones, just some ideas about speeding up permits for small businesses. The whole system was built on elite-driven growth. If the political leadership becomes actively hostile to those elites,
that engine could stall very quickly.
Very quickly. And Mandani's challenge gets even tougher because the city's current budget relies heavily on federal funds, about $7.4 billion. If Mandani wins, you can bet the president will likely turn hostile, potentially cutting off that funding stream, further tightening the financial screws on the city.
A really difficult situation. Okay, from a city possibly facing a fiscal death spiral, let's pivot to a country that's lived through economic chaos for decades, but just delivered a stunning, almost historic endorsement of radical austerity. We're talking about Argentina.
Yeah, the result of the midterm elections there was genuinely shocking. Javier Milei's party, Liberty Advances, LLA, they grabbed 41% of the vote, absolutely trounced the traditional Peronists, who only got 32%.
And this wasn't expected.
Not at all. It confounded all the pollsters, all the market expectations. LLA even won in Buenos Aires province, which is usually a solid Peronist stronghold. It just shows how deep the dissatisfaction runs.
The analysis calls Milei's spending cuts historic. Why? We've seen austerity plenty of times before.
What makes them historic, according to the analysis, is that these cuts are perhaps the deepest and fastest ever imposed on a country through broad democratic consent.
Democratic consent being the key.
Exactly. Usually, austerity this severe is forced on a country by international bodies. Think of the Troika in Greece after the financial crisis. And it's met with huge popular anger, massive street protests.
But Argentinians voted for the pain.
They voted for Milei after they'd already started feeling the effects of his chainsaw policies.
Hmm.
You know, the analogy he literally carried around during his campaign. It shows the power of a tough, clear economic message, especially when delivered with conviction. Maybe it's easier to sell fiscal realism to Argentines, who have generations of direct experience with hyperinflation and currency crises. They're just sick of the chaos.
So what does this landslide win actually give Milei in terms of power to push his agenda?
Well, crucially, he now has enough deputies in Congress to block any attempts by the opposition, mainly the Peronists, to restore public spending. He can use his presidential veto effectively.
That strengthens his hand significantly.
Dramatically. And it gives him the momentum he needs to try and build a coalition for his next wave of reforms. Things like cleaning up Argentina's incredibly complex tax system, liberalizing the notoriously rigid labor markets, maybe even overhauling public pensions. His mandate is undeniable now.
We should probably pause here and mention the external help Argentina got just before the election. That must have played a role.
Oh, absolutely. The Trump administration stepped in with some pretty extraordinary unconventional support. The U.S. provided a massive $20 billion swap line to Argentina's central bank.
$20 billion.
Yeah. And on top of that, the U.S. made direct, very visible purchases of the Argentine peso on the open market, estimated around $2 billion worth.
So basically propping up the currency.
Definitely helped stabilize it. This financial intervention almost certainly helped Milei win by preventing the kind of currency crash many analysts were predicting right before the vote.
So now he has a mandate. He has this external backing. What's his most urgent task?
The really urgent task is to finish Argentina's journey back to something resembling macroeconomic normality. And that starts with fully floating the peso.
He hadn't done that yet.
No. He'd been relying on an artificially strong fixed exchange rate to sort of temporarily squash inflation. It provided some stability, sure, but it was hurting exports and stopping the central bank from building up foreign reserves.
But now he can afford to float it.
His victory, plus the U.S. support, makes an orderly float much more achievable. Now he needs to follow through. Use high interest rates to keep inflation anchored, build up those foreign reserves. That's the only way Argentina can regain access to global capital markets, which it desperately needs to do to roll over about $20 billion in debt coming due next year. Stabilization is key.
Okay, one last stop in this section, shifting back to Europe and the Netherlands election. Another example of intense political polarization and fragmentation, right?
Very much so. The result was a dead heat, basically. The centrist liberal D66 party, led by Rob Jetten, tied with Geert Wilders' hard-right Party for Freedom, the PV,
mm-hmm.
both got around 16.7% of the vote, which translates to 26 seats each.
A tie, but Jetten is likely to be PM.
Yes. It was actually a huge gain for D66. They only had 9 seats before. And Jetten is poised to become the Netherlands' next prime minister, their youngest ever, and also their first openly gay PM.
Why him and not Wilders if they tied?
Because almost every other major mainstream party has completely ruled out forming a coalition with Wilders' PV again. They did it once before. It ended badly. So even though PV got a similar share of the vote, they're effectively locked out of power.
But governing will still be tough for Jetten. The Netherlands is famous for fractured politics.
Extremely tough. Forming a coalition is going to be agony. 15 different parties made it into parliament this time.
15?
Yeah. So Jetten will likely need a coalition of 4, maybe even 5 parties just to get a bare majority. And even though his progressive liberal party came out on top, tied, the overall mood of the country hasn't swung dramatically left.
What are the core issues driving this?
The really big domestic issues are intense. There's a severe housing shortage, about 400,000 homes needed, which is fueling inflation. Waiting lists for social housing can stretch up to 10 years in some cities. And alongside that, there's still very high public demand for reducing immigration levels.
So Jetten needs a stable coalition to tackle these huge problems.
But his potential coalition partners are already drawing lines in the sand, ruling each other out on ideological grounds. It's a massive governing challenge that could easily lead to instability. Or it might force Jetten to make uncomfortable deals with some of the more right-wing parties he'd probably rather avoid.
Okay, let's move on. The fiscal and political shocks we've discussed, they feel like serious domestic worries. But they arguably pale next to the sheer existential threat of the ongoing war in Europe and other escalating conflicts around the globe. Let's start with Ukraine. The analysis says the war has fundamentally shifted now, away from ground combat to a power war. What does that mean?
That's the absolutely critical strategic shift. Vladimir Putin's ground war just isn't working. Russia's lost hundreds of thousands of soldiers this year alone. For what? Less than 1% gain of Ukrainian territory.
So he's changing tactics.
Completely. His strategy has shifted to terror and infrastructure destruction. He's now laser-focused on systematically wrecking Ukraine's energy infrastructure. The heating systems, the power grid, the gas network.
The goal isn't conquest anymore.
No, the goal seems much more cynical now. It's to make large parts of Ukraine, especially the industrial east, simply uninhabitable, to undermine Ukraine's ability to produce its own weapons, and, critically, to encourage another massive wave of refugees as the brutal winter really bites.
We saw evidence of this just recently.
Yeah, just days before President Trump met with Zelensky, Russian missiles and drones knocked out Kyiv's water supply completely. The metro system went dark for the first time since the invasion started. The strategy is clearly to break the Ukrainian state's basic ability to function and care for its people.
And the source material described a terrifying escalation in drone warfare. Russia's air campaign is evolving faster than Ukraine can keep up.
The escalation is really dramatic. Russia isn't just relying on expensive, limited supply missiles anymore. Now they're hitting specific regions with huge waves of these newer, cheaper, Shahed-like drones.
How huge are these waves?
A year ago, maybe 150 drones in a single night was considered a major attack. Now, Ukraine is frequently facing 600 or 700 drones per night.
600 or 700, that volume alone must be overwhelming.
The sheer volume makes interception completely unsustainable in the long run. But it's also the technology that's improving. These are now AI-enhanced drones. They can travel at over 300 kilometers per hour. They're using AI to counter Ukrainian jamming attempts. And crucially, they're attacking from almost vertical angles.
Coming straight down.
Pretty much. That high-angle approach puts them outside the effective range of a lot of traditional ground-based air defenses. Makes it almost impossible to shoot them down with machine guns. And because they're cheap and plentiful, Russia can just keep hammering away, systematically targeting vital infrastructure.
So protecting every potential target is basically impossible now. The focus has to be on the most critical points.
Precisely. Ukraine's entire power transmission grid relies on about 90 absolutely crucial substations. These convert the high-voltage current for regional networks. And Russia is just systematically targeting them one by one.
And Ukraine wasn't prepared for this specific threat.
The problem is made worse because Ukraine seems to have lacked some systemic defensive planning. Many of these critical nodes were supposed to be protected with reinforced concrete bunkers, but apparently many weren't built or weren't reinforced adequately.
So the prospect for this winter is grim.
Very grim. Prolonged, nationwide blackouts affecting many regions hitting both electricity and gas are a very real possibility this winter, potentially much worse than anything Ukraine has experienced so far in this war.
And given that U.S. financial aid to Ukraine effectively stopped when President Trump returned to office in January, the burden of funding this war effort now falls almost entirely on Europe, doesn't it?
Almost entirely, yes.
What's the scale of the financial test Europe is facing now?
It's daunting, no question. But the analysis interestingly calls it an excellent bargain for Europe.
A bargain? How so?
The calculation goes like this. Ukraine is going to need roughly $390 billion in cash and weapons from Europe alone over the next 4 years. That's 2026 to 2029. That's almost double what Europe has provided since the war began.
$390 billion. How can Europe afford that?
To meet that need, the financial commitment from the non-U.S. NATO members needs to basically double, going from about 0.2% of their combined GDP up to 0.4%.
Still sounds like a lot.
It is a lot. But the analysis argues that's still excellent value compared to the alternative, Ukraine losing the war. Imagine Ukraine becoming this embittered, semi-failed state on Europe's border with a massive, battle-hardened army that Putin could potentially exploit to destabilize the entire region.
Yeah.
Compared to that catastrophe, 0.4% of GDP looks like a bargain.
Okay, it's a huge sum. Where is this $390 billion supposed to come from? And why is there so much conflict over using the frozen Russian assets? That seems like the obvious source.
Europe desperately needs this money, yeah. And the most obvious pot is at $163 billion worth of frozen Russian state assets, most of which are sitting in accounts in Belgium.
Okay, $163 billion, that's a big chunk. But you said Ukraine needs $390 billion over 4 years.
Right. That frozen asset amount is about $30 billion short of what's needed just for the military and budget support in the first few years. But even getting that $163 billion moving is proving incredibly difficult because of deep political and legal resistance.
What's the holdup?
It's sort of threefold. First, Belgium, where most of the money is held, is nervous. They fear the financial risk. They're arguing that the proposed national guarantees for the new EU bonds needed to finance this loan aren't strong enough. They're worried they'll be left holding the bag if Russia defaults or retaliates somehow.
Okay, financial risk. What else?
Second, there's a major disagreement on how the money should even be spent. Germany's Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, is adamant the money should only be used to buy weapons. That reflects Germany's traditionally cautious fiscal approach, focusing purely on the military side.
But Ukraine needs more than just weapons, right?
Exactly. Ukrainian officials say that's just not feasible. They desperately need that money to plug huge holes in their civilian budget, paying teachers, doctors, just keeping the basic functions of the state running. Without that, the whole country could collapse, regardless of weapons.
So Belgium's nervous, Germany wants weapons only, Ukraine needs budget support. What's the third issue?
The third is the legal complexity of using the principal amount of the assets, not just the interest that's accrued. Seizing the principal is a huge legal step, and the full legal groundwork for that just hasn't been completely cleared yet across the EU.
So internal EU squabbling is basically stalling this potentially game-changing reparations loan. What's the ultimate takeaway for Europe here?
The key message is that Europe has to show strategic persistence to Russia. They need to demonstrate clearly that they will back Ukraine financially and militarily for at least another 5 years, no matter who is sitting in the White House.
And that persistence could actually pressure Putin?
That persistence, combined with Russia's own mounting financial problems, defense spending hitting $160 billion next year, severe labor shortages, 8% inflation, cripplingly high 16.5% interest rates, that's the only external pressure that might realistically trigger a banking crisis in Russia and truly put Putin in a corner.
So if the reparations loan stays stalled,
then the analysis suggests Europe should seriously consider joint borrowing, similar to the post-pandemic recovery fund. Even though Germany has historically hated the idea of common EU debt, the stakes are arguably high enough to justify it now.
This European funding dilemma really highlights the need for greater strategic autonomy, doesn't it? Let's shift focus now to other global conflict zones and recent outbreaks of violence, starting in South America with that incredibly bloody police operation in Brazil.
Yeah, that was a really shocking event in Rio de Janeiro. It targeted leaders of the Red Command, which is Brazil's second biggest drug gang. The security forces went in hard armored trucks, police helicopters into the favelas.
And the death toll was huge.
Horrific. At least 121 people were killed, including four police officers. That makes it the single biggest and deadliest police operation in Brazil's entire history, even worse than a notorious prison massacre back in 1992.
And there were disturbing reports about how people died.
Very disturbing. Locals reported finding some victims with their hands tied, or apparently shot or even stabbed from behind. That strongly suggests summary executions might have taken place during the raid.
How did this brutality land politically in Brazil? It sounds like it exposed deep divisions.
It absolutely ripped open Brazil's political divides, especially with elections coming up next year. The far right, led by Rio's governor Cláudio Castro, immediately celebrated the Iron Fist approach. They basically claimed all the dead were criminals and the only real victims were the police officers who died. Rio's mayor quickly backed him up, saying the city can't be held hostage by gangs, essentially endorsing the militarized tactics.
And the left, President Lula's government.
They were forced into a much more cautious, critical position. President Lula called an emergency cabinet meeting. His justice minister, Ricardo Lewandowski, called the raid very bloody and offered condolences to innocent families caught in the middle. Meanwhile, the UN expressed deep dismay and immediately demanded an independent investigation. Security is always a top political issue in Brazil, and you can be sure right-wing candidates will use this raid to push their uncompromising, militarized campaigns.
Moving across the Atlantic to Africa now, the 18-month siege of El Fasher in Sudan has ended in horror, raising fears of catastrophic ethnic violence.
It really has. The rebel group, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, they took full control of El Fasher. This was the last major city in Darfur that was outside their control, and they'd been besieging it for 18 long months.
And as soon as it fell?
As soon as it fell on October 27th, reports started pouring out about widespread ethnic cleansing and summary executions, specifically targeting non-Arab civilians. Satellite imagery seems to confirm killings at a detention site and even at a hospital.
This is terrifyingly familiar territory for Darfur, isn't it?
Deeply alarming, because the RSF grew directly out of the Janjaweed militias. the Arab militias responsible for the first Darfur genocide about 20 years ago. Conflict monitors like Nathaniel Raymond at Yale are now warning about the potential for Rwanda-style hyperviolence because the RSF appears to be deliberately targeting specific non-Arab groups, especially the Masalit people.
What about the Sudanese army?
General Al-Burhan, the army chief, claims his forces pulled back strategically to try and spare the remaining 260,000 residents in the city from the RSF's brutality. But the city is now under RSF control. In response to this horror, the U.S. Senate has now called for the RSF to be formally designated as a terrorist group. That reflects just how severe and organized these atrocities appear to be.
Finally, in this grim roundup, let's look at the Gaza ceasefire. It seems to be holding, but just barely, despite major U.S. intervention.
Extremely fragile is the right way to put it. That fragility was on full display when Israeli strikes killed over 100 people. The Hamas-run authorities didn't specify combatants versus civilians supposedly in retaliation for an Israeli soldier being killed near Rafah. Hamas denied they were responsible for the soldier's death.
So why is the truce holding at all?
Primarily because of immense direct U.S. pressure. The U.S. even installed a civil military coordination center led by a 4-star U.S. admiral right there on the ground to ensure Israel sticks strictly to the agreement and that communication lines stay open to prevent misunderstandings escalating.
But the path to any kind of long-term stability looks incredibly complicated. It involves setting up a new technocratic government and deploying an International Stabilization Force, or ISF. How are those plans progressing?
Well, forming the new technocratic government, which would replace the Hamas authorities in Gaza, that seems to be nearing completion. Israel and Egypt are reportedly haggling over the final names for some key non-political officials.
But the ISF, the Stabilization Force, that's much less certain.
Far more uncertain. So far, no major Western power and no major regional power either has actually formally pledged to send troops for this ISF.
And Israel is making it more complicated.
Israel has complicated things, yes. They've explicitly vetoed Turkey participating in any force. That's because of the Turkish government's virulently anti-Israel stance and its open support for Hamas.
So who does Israel want in the force?
Instead of Turkey, Israel is leaning heavily on the U.S. to pressure two specific Muslim-majority countries, Azerbaijan and Indonesia, to contribute troops.
Azerbaijan and Indonesia, that seems unexpected.
It's a very delicate geopolitical balancing act. Neither Azerbaijan nor Indonesia even has formal diplomatic ties with Israel, but they're being courted because presumably they want to curry favor with the current U.S. administration.
But are Israeli security officials actually confident this ISF will work, even if it deploys?
Highly skeptical is the short answer. Even if the ISF does deploy, the prevailing view within the Israeli security establishment seems to be that the force will just end up monitoring the ceasefire. They don't think it will have the mandate or the willingness to actually take on Hamas directly if Hamas refuses to disarm.
So it doesn't solve the core problem?
No. The long-term analysis suggests this stabilization force basically kicks the can down the road on disarmament. It leaves that crucial issue either to some highly unlikely internal Palestinian pressure, or, more probably, it means Israel feels it will eventually have to go back in again and do it ourselves. So the ISF is really seen as a temporary stopgap, not a lasting solution.
Okay, let's transition now to the world of business and technology, starting with the fierce AI arms race. We're seeing these divergent strategies from Microsoft and Google, and it's all fueled by absolutely massive spending, isn't it?
Huge spending, yeah. We saw that reflected in the latest quarterly earnings. Alphabet, Google's parent company, topped $100 billion in quarterly revenue for the first time ever. That's a major milestone.
And Meta and Microsoft also did well.
Yeah, Meta and Microsoft also beat profit and revenue expectations. But, and this is the key point, the huge increases in costs tied to AI development really spooked some investors. Spending on specialized chips, building out data centers, hiring top AI talent. It's costing billions just to stay in the game.
Microsoft, of course, kind of surprised everyone by becoming an early leader in this space, mainly through its massive partnership with OpenAI. Can you break down the structure of that deal and why it became the industry standard, at least initially?
Sure. The updated partnership agreement really lays out the blueprint for what became the sort of decentralized AI model. It confirms OpenAI is rapidly moving towards a full for-profit setup. It's now valued as a behemoth, a staggering $500 billion valuation.
Half a trillion dollars.
Incredible, isn't it? Microsoft keeps a big chunk, a 27% stake in OpenAI, and it gets 20% of OpenAI's revenue until Microsoft recoups its initial $13 billion investment.
And crucially, Microsoft gets access to the tech.
Until 2032, yes. Microsoft gets rights to all of OpenAI's core technology, including, if it ever actually happens, artificial general intelligence or superintelligence. Plus, OpenAI is committing to spend a massive $250 billion on Microsoft's Azure cloud services over the next few years.
So this model relies on outsiders.
Right, relying on external chip makers like NVIDIA and partnering with a brilliant external lab like OpenAI that became the decentralized kind of mix and match industry standard that everyone else was trying to copy.
Okay, so that's the Microsoft OpenAI model. Now, contrast that with Google's strategy vertical integration. They were initially seen as an AI laggard, weren't they?
They were. Google's really the only major player that went all in on vertical integration from the start. They decided to build basically every layer of the AI stack themselves, internally.
How does that work in practice?
Well, Google Cloud installs Google's own custom-designed chips, the Tensor Processing Units, or TPUs, for training the AI models. The models themselves are built by Google's wholly in-house lab, Google DeepMind, and then those models power all of Google's products, search, YouTube, everything.
And why was that seen as slow initially?
It was seen as flat-footed because it seemed less nimble, maybe more bureaucratic, than the Microsoft OpenAI approach, where they could theoretically swap components in and out more quickly.
But the analysis suggests the tide is turning, that vertical integration is starting to pay off.
Absolutely. It seems the long game is starting to work for Google. Despite that initial perceived inertia and the deep irony that Google's own researchers published the key academic paper that directly led to ChatGPT.
Right, the Transformer paper.
That's the one. Despite that, their long-term investment in custom TPUs and keeping DeepMind in-house is really starting to deliver results. Just look at the stock market. In the past 4 months alone, Alphabet has gained a remarkable $1 trillion in market value.
$1 trillion in 4 months.
Yeah. Dramatically narrowing the valuation gap with Microsoft. And the reason seems to be efficiency.
How is vertical integration more efficient?
Because by controlling the chip design, the software layer that runs on those chips, and the AI models themselves, Google is cutting out massive intermediate costs. They don't have to pay NVIDIA's margins, for example. This is significantly boosting Google Cloud's profit margins much faster than its competitors are seeing.
So Google's efficiency is now forcing rivals to rethink their strategies?
Precisely. Google's success with the vertical model is now pushing its rivals to try and mimic the very strategy they previously dismissed. OpenAI, apparently bleeding billions on compute costs, is now reportedly planning to develop its own custom silicon.
And Microsoft.
Microsoft is also now trying to build its own in-house chips and AI models, though their second-generation chip, Maya, has already been delayed, which shows just how hard it is to catch up once you've fallen behind in that integrated approach. Google's initial slowness might actually be turning into a major long-term strategic advantage because of the sheer cost efficiency of its internal stack.
Okay, let's shift gears now to some specific corporate headaches, starting with Porsche, a brand synonymous with luxury and performance, but it seems to be accelerating fast in the wrong financial direction.
Yeah, the warning lights are flashing bright red at Porsche right now. The company just issued its third profit warning this year. And worse, it posted an operating loss in the third quarter of almost 1 billion euros.
A billion euro loss for Porsche.
Unthinkable, right?
Yeah.
Their market value has basically halved since they listed on the stock market just 3 years ago. The new CEO, Michael Leiters, he's facing three really daunting interconnected challenges that are threatening to completely derail the brand's legendary profitability.
Okay, what are those three big challenges? Let's start with the electric vehicle shift.
Right. First is their floundering EV rollout.
Yeah.
It turns out Porsche customers, the high-end buyers, are proving much more hesitant to embrace purely battery-powered sports cars than the company anticipated.
So they had to backtrack.
Big time. They've had to ditch that high-profile goal of having 80% of their sales be electric by 2030. They've had delays and changes to key product plans, like the crucial all-electric version of their Macan SUV. That's added significant costs and years to the launch schedule.
Customers just aren't buying into electric sports cars yet.
It seems not, or at least not at the rate Porsche hoped. They're even being forced to offer a new top-of-the-line SUV as a hybrid petrol option instead of pure electric as originally planned. That really shows a lack of customer confidence in long-range electric sports performance right now.
Okay, so EV troubles. What's the second challenge?
Second, the Chinese market has shrunk dramatically for them. Sales in China might only hit 40,000 cars this year. That's down drastically from 93,000 just back in 2022.
Why the big drop in China?
It's partly due to rising local competition from Chinese EV makers, sure. But it's also a failure by Porsche to adapt. Their infotainment systems, developed mainly in Europe, apparently feel really dated and clunky compared to what Chinese buyers expect now in terms of seamless integration of features. It makes the cars feel old tech in their biggest potential market.
Okay, EV woes, shrinking China sales. And the third challenge loops right back to the geopolitics we discussed earlier, U.S. trade policy.
Exactly. The third major headache is dealing with the new U.S. tariffs. The U.S. has recently overtaken China again to become Porsche's single largest global market.
All right.
So President Trump slapping that blanket 15% tariff on all cars imported from Europe, that's a massive blow. It could wipe an estimated 700 million off Porsche's profits this year alone.
700 million euros just from the tariff.
Yeah. So the new CEO, Leiters, has this immediate horrible decision to make. Does he try politically difficult price hikes, which would definitely hurt sales? Or does Porsche just absorb this massive financial hit? They don't have any factories in the U.S. to build cars locally and bypass the tariffs. So that geopolitical decision made in Washington translates directly into a billion-euro scale crisis for a major European company.
From struggling luxury cars to very old money, let's talk about the remarkable Wallenberg dynasty in Sweden and their big generational shift.
The Wallenbergs are really extraordinary. One of the most powerful, yet deliberately low-profile family enterprises in Europe.
Hmm.
They effectively control something like 35% of the total value of the entire Swedish stock exchange.
35%? How?
Through major controlling stakes in Sweden's corporate giants, companies like Ericsson and Telecoms, Saab Defense and Aerospace, SEB Bank and Finance, their family motto sums it up perfectly. Esse non videri.
Which means?
To be, not to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
They are masters of wielding immense influence without ever seeking the public spotlight.
And now they're navigating a tricky generational succession. How is this one different from past transitions, which were sometimes difficult?
Well, the succession is definitely underway. The three main leaders of the fifth generation are all in their mid to late 60s now. And yes, past successions were sometimes incredibly stressful. One anointed heir tragically took his own life under the pressure.
If they've learned from that.
It seems so. The transition to the sixth generation is being handled much more deliberately, maybe more democratically this time. The potential candidates have been encouraged to sort of choose their own path within the family sphere rather than having roles dictated from above.
How many contenders are there?
There are about 30 potential contenders in the sixth generation, all being rigorously assessed for various roles. And significantly, for the first time ever, women are being formally included in the top-level succession process. Someone like Stephanie Glanzka recently joined the board of KW, which is the largest and most important of their controlling foundations.
And these foundations are key to their structure?
Absolutely key. The entire empire relies on a network of 16 tax-advantaged foundations. These foundations hold the shares, maintain control, ensure the wealth stays largely within the family's sphere of influence, and crucially, keep the core enterprises Swedish-owned and controlled. The Wallenbergs are really setting a template for how these huge, long-established family dynasties can try to navigate generational change while holding on to power.
Okay, finally in this business section, let's discuss a really big macro trend with potentially huge implications for all of us as consumers. The idea of the end of the rip-off economy being driven by AI.
Yeah, this is a potentially profound shift towards greater market efficiency, all thanks to AI. For centuries, huge profits have been made from what economists call information asymmetry.
Information asymmetry, meaning?
Meaning the seller or the intermediary simply knows a lot more than the buyer. Think about medieval grocers using dodgy scales, right? Or George Akerlof's Nobel Prize winning work on the used car market. The seller knows if they're selling you a lemon, but you don't. AI is starting to systematically dismantle that imbalance.
How? What are the practical ways people are using AI right now to overcome that information disadvantage?
Oh, the examples are popping up everywhere, and they're growing fast. People are now routinely using large language models like ChatGPT or Claude to analyze really complex legal documents before they sign them.
Like car contracts, service agreements.
Exactly. Feeding the AI the PDF and asking it to flag any exploitative clauses, you can do that in seconds. People are giving models a restaurant's wine list PDF and asking, what's the best value bottle here? Based on vintage, supplier reputation, critic scores.
That's clever. What else?
Consulting specialized chatbots for basic medical advice instead of waiting weeks for a doctor's appointment for something minor. There are startups like CarEdge that use AI negotiators to haggle with car dealerships over price, apparently getting better deals than most humans can negotiate themselves. The analysis even suggests the new stereotype is that Gen Z won't buy a car without running the contract through an AI first.
This goes way beyond just convenience, doesn't it? The potential impact is massive.
The stakes are absolutely enormous. Think about those industries where information asymmetry is rampant and costs consumers billions. Healthcare, legal services, home renovation, dealing with contractors, HVAC companies, even real estate. These asymmetries impose what the analysis calls an effective consumer tax worth hundreds of billions of dollars every year in the U.S. alone.
Can you give an example?
Take U.S. healthcare. It's estimated it weighs maybe $100 billion a year just on unnecessary overtreatment and low-value procedures, partly because patients simply lack the information or confidence to question their providers effectively.
So if AI can level that playing field?
If AI can eliminate that opacity, democratize specialist knowledge, it's a huge win for consumers. It radically improves economic efficiency. And yes, it could potentially put legions of traditional intermediaries whose main value was controlling information, like maybe some real estate brokers or certain types of financial advisors, it could put them out of business.
The end of the ripoff economy, an optimistic take on technology's power. Let's shift now to look at where technology is trying to save lives versus where policy decisions might be tragically failing them, starting with the collapse of global health aid.
Yeah, this is a really heartbreaking story and a critical policy failure unfolding right now. The source describes it starkly. America first means Africa last. The Trump administration is actively dismantling the U.S. Agency for International Development, USA. And the proposed budget includes a devastating two-thirds cut to bilateral health funding, the money aimed directly at developing nations.
Just put that into context for people who might not realize how big America's role was in global health. Why is this cut so devastating?
The U.S. has historically been the dominant player. America supplied more than two-thirds, over 66% of all the bilateral aid specifically for public health going to sub-Saharan Africa.
Two-thirds of the total.
Yeah. The U.S. essentially became the indispensable funder for African public health systems, especially through huge programs like PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief.
And the impact on national budgets was huge.
Foundational. In 21 different African countries, USAID accounted for at least 20% of the entire government's health spending. And in three extremely vulnerable countries, Somalia, South Sudan, Malawi, USAID actually exceeded what the government itself spent on health. So pulling that anchor out causes absolute systemic chaos. It's creating a silent health catastrophe.
What are the specific immediate consequences being seen right now on the ground because of these funding cuts?
The effects are immediate and severe, hitting the most vulnerable hardest. Across southern Africa, clinics that supply HIV patients with those life-saving antiretroviral drugs, the ARVs funded by PEPFAR, they've either run out completely or they're strictly rationing supplies.
So people are losing access to life-saving medication.
Yes. You're seeing clinics in South Africa getting swamped by HIV-positive migrants coming from neighboring countries like Eswatini, Lesotho, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, because those people simply can't get their meds in their own countries anymore due to the funding cuts. Deliveries of anti-malarial treatments have been severely disrupted. Cholera deaths are reportedly rising in affected regions. Even basic food rations in huge refugee camps, like the Chiriandago camp in Uganda, are shrinking dramatically.
This sounds truly catastrophic. What's the overall forecast? Is there an estimate of the human cost?
The forecast is grim, and it's based on rigorous analysis. Health analysts estimate that these budget proposals put as many as 1 million lives at risk over the next few years, mostly from easily preventable deaths due to untreated HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria.
A million lives.
A million lives. And what makes it a silent crisis is that many of the American-funded data tracking systems, the systems that used to monitor disease outbreaks and track how well interventions were working, they've largely gone dark now because their funding was cut too.
So we don't even have the full picture of the damage being done.
Exactly. The administration's stated goal is to promote self-reliance in Africa. But analysts argue the poorest countries simply cannot do more without this baseline funding. And ultimately, the world is less safe if global disease surveillance systems are defunded and infections are allowed to spread across borders unchecked.
From that systemic, policy-driven tragedy, let's turn to a medical miracle happening right now. Xenotransplants. Technology attempting to save lives in a completely different way, using pigs as future organ suppliers.
Yeah, this is truly mind-bending science, defying decades of skepticism. Tim Andrews, a British pensioner, received a kidney transplant from a genetically modified pig at Massachusetts General Hospital. And that transplanted pig kidney lasted an incredible 271 days inside him. That's a new world record.
271 days. That's amazing. Xenotransplantation felt like science fiction for so long.
It really did. For decades, it was kind of the fusion energy of medicine, always promising, always 20 years away, never quite real. But that is changing incredibly fast now.
What's the significance of this 271-day record, and what happens next in terms of clinical use?
The sheer longevity of the organ functioning 271 days, that's the crucial breakthrough. It was enough to convince the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, to finally give official permission to two companies, eGenesis and United Therapeutics, to start the first proper full-scale clinical trials of pig kidneys in human patients.
So moving from one-off experiments to actual trials.
Exactly. eGenesis is planning to start its trial early next year. And this is so vital because the global need for organs is just immense. Less than 10% of the worldwide need for kidney transplants is currently met. In the U.S. alone, 13 people die every single day while waiting on the transplant list.
So how does the technology actually work? How do they stop the human body from violently rejecting an animal organ? We heard the phrase 10-edit pig formula. What does that mean biologically?
It all comes down to CRISPR gene editing technology. Our human immune systems are hardwired to recognize animal organs as foreign invaders and destroy them almost instantly, hyperacute rejection. The 10-edit pig formula is the current best workaround. Scientists use CRISPR to make about 10 precise genetic changes to the pig embryo. They knock out or disable three or four specific pig genes that produce certain sugar molecules, like one called alpha-gal, which are major triggers for that immediate human immune attack.
Okay, so they remove the pig triggers. What else?
Then they knock in or insert six or seven human genes into the pig's genome. These human genes act like a biological disguise, helping to cloak the organ from the human immune system, prevent rejection, and also address other problems like blood clotting that would otherwise quickly destroy the pig organ in a human body.
So they create these genetically tailored pigs.
Exactly. They create cloned, gene-edited piglets whose organs are much, much more tolerable to the human immune system.
But despite the 271-day record, you said challenges remain. These trials are still essential.
Absolutely essential. Because despite that longevity record, both of the major pig kidney recipients we know about, Tim Andrews, and another patient named Tuana Looney, who received a kidney from a rival company's pig, Jill, both have now had those pig kidneys removed.
Oh, they had to be removed. Why?
Because of slow but persistent rejection issues developing over time. Tim Andrews' kidney function was gradually declining, forcing him back onto dialysis. So it underscores that while the technology is genuinely groundbreaking, we desperately need the data from these larger clinical trials. We need to figure out if we need further tweaks to the 10-edit formula itself, or maybe changes to the powerful immunosuppressant drugs patients take afterwards, or even refinements to the surgical procedure. The trials will tell us.
Okay, let's pivot back to the UK now and look at a crucial social system described as fundamentally broken: special educational needs and disability support, known as SEND.
Yeah, the SEND system in England is in a state of massive crisis. It's completely unsustainable. Spending has almost doubled in the last decade, hitting a staggering 15.5 billion hours a year. Yet, despite that huge cost increase, the system is widely seen as failing. Teachers feel overwhelmed, local councils are going broke, and most importantly, children with needs are suffering because they aren't getting timely support.
And the root cause seems to be the unintended consequences of a law passed back in 2014.
Exactly. The 2014 Children and Families Act is at the heart of the problem.
What was the core flaw in that act? How did it lead to spending doubling while services seemingly collapsed?
The act created a very powerful legal right for children with significant needs to get something called an Education, Health and Care Plan, or EHCP. An EHCP is a legally binding document. It specifies exactly what support and funding a child must receive, and it legally forces the local authority, the council, to pay for it.
That sounds good in principle, giving parents legal power.
It sounded good, and it was meant for children with the most severe and complex needs. But here's the problem. Around the same time, other less formal types of support within mainstream schools were being cut back due to general budget austerity.
Ah, so the EHCP became the only game in town.
Precisely. It created this perverse incentive. Schools, and especially parents, quickly realized that fighting for one of these legally binding, often very expensive EHCPs was the only reliable way to guarantee any significant extra support for their child.
So demand for EHCPs exploded.
Exploded. The number of pupils with an EHCP has surged. It's now over 500,000 children in England, which is about one in every 20 pupils. That's a fivefold increase since the act was passed. It's become an all-or-nothing system.
And this massive influx of legally mandated expensive plans created a boom for private providers.
A huge, highly profitable boom. Because the state schools and the local authorities simply couldn't cope with the sheer volume or the complexity of needs specified in these EHCPs, the number of children being placed in private special schools has soared from about 10,000 to 30,000 in the last decade.
And these private schools cost a fortune.
They charge enormous premiums, often astronomical amounts up to $114,000 per pupil, per year in some cases.
Yeah.
And the local authorities are legally obligated to pay it if the EHCBP demands it.
So it's guaranteed income for the private schools.
Guaranteed cash flow. And that has attracted massive investment from private equity firms, even, bizarrely, from Abu Dhabi's sovereign wealth fund. The whole system has become this engine of conflict, litigation, and gross misallocation of resources. It punishes poorer families who often can't afford the lawyers needed to fight for an EHCP in the first place.
So what's the proposed fix? And is it even politically possible to take away that legal power parents now have?
Well, the consensus among experts seems to be that the best long-term solution is to reinvest funding and flexibility back into mainstream schools so they can actually meet the needs of all pupils without needing these crushing legal plans for so many.
But taking away the EHCP right, that sounds politically toxic.
Incredibly difficult, because you'd be removing this hard-won legal power that many parents, especially those who've battled the system for years, see as their absolute lifeline, their only safeguard. Any realistic transition would likely require a massive, very expensive period of double funding, investing heavily in mainstream schools before you even think about phasing out the legal EHCP requirement. You'd have to convince parents that the new general support will actually be better, not just another hidden budget cut.
It sounds incredibly complex, but one city, Portsmouth, is trying an interesting alternative, something that avoids the medical diagnosis bottleneck.
Yes. The Portsmouth alternative is getting a lot of attention internationally. What they've done is stop automatically referring every child with behavioral or learning difficulties to the National Health Service for a formal medical diagnosis, a process which had waiting lists stretching up to 10 years in some parts of the country.
10 years? So what do they do instead?
Instead, the schools work directly with parents to draw up a simple neurodiversity profile for the child. It focuses on the child's strengths, but also identifies simple, practical, low-cost adaptations that can be made in the classroom right away.
Like what kind of adaptations?
Really basic, but often highly effective things. Giving a child a timeout pass so they can leave the classroom for a few minutes if they feel overwhelmed. Providing fidget tools. Maybe using lyrics from the child's favorite pop star as a worked example in an English lesson to keep them engaged.
So focusing on immediate practical help, not waiting for a label.
Exactly. It focuses on practical support rather than getting bogged down in expensive, often clinically useless, formal paperwork. And crucially, it keeps the expertise and the funding within the mainstream school system where it can benefit more children more quickly.
Okay, fascinating. Finally, in this section, let's look skywards briefly. A Welsh startup called SpaceForge trying to tackle the semiconductor supply chain from orbit.
Yeah, SpaceForge is a really interesting startup. Their goal is to manufacture highly specialized semiconductor materials and unique metal alloys in orbit, leveraging the microgravity and near-perfect vacuum of space.
Why do that? What's the advantage?
In microgravity, you can create materials with much purer crystal structures, potentially leading to far more efficient semiconductors or stronger, lighter alloys than you can make on Earth where gravity interferes.
And the relevance is geopolitical.
Entirely driven by geopolitics. With all the U.S.-China tension and the fragility we've seen in global supply chains, there's this huge push in Europe for greater resilience and sovereignty, especially in critical areas like minerals and semiconductors. After watching America's aggressive onshoring efforts, Europe sees ventures like SpaceForge as a potential step towards achieving its own strategic autonomy.
But how do they get the valuable materials back down to Earth safely? That's always been a challenge for space manufacturing.
That's been the key hurdle. Their main innovation is a foldable ceramic heat shield they call PIDWIN. It's designed to allow the satellite containing the manufactured materials to survive reentry safely and, crucially, be reused multiple times. That drastically changes the economics.
So it sounds promising. Are they getting support?
They are. They've secured funding from NATO's Innovation Fund. There's rising international interest. But they're facing some very terrestrial challenges back in the UK.
Such as?
Extremely high energy costs in the UK are a major problem for their ground operations. And also, crippling levels of bureaucratic inertia, apparently, There are 10 different government agencies involved in overseeing space activity in the UK.
10 agencies?
Yeah, and that friction on the ground is actually leading Space Force to set up an operational arm in the US, partly to escape the bureaucracy, but also to take advantage of the massive subsidies available there through the American Cheap PS Act. So a UK innovation potentially boosting US manufacturing due to hurdles at home.
Okay, let's move into our final section, looking at culture, history, and social trends. We start right at the top. The White House, and the president's renovation plans, which the source describes using the rather loaded term dictator style.
Yeah, this revolves around the president's surprise announcement that he's building a beautiful ballroom, which in practice meant bulldozing the historic East Wing of the White House, first built back in 1902.
Bulldozing the East Wing, wow. And the critique is about the style itself.
Very much so. The descriptions are pretty vivid. Gold heavy, completely over the top. The analysis likens it to Caesar's Palace meets the Palace of Versailles, and argues this fits perfectly into a recognized aesthetic category known as dictator style.
Dictator style. What's the psychology behind that specific look, and who is it actually meant to impress or maybe intimidate?
The style is fundamentally about signaling power and permanence, often in a way that deliberately shocks the existing establishment. Peter York, a style guru quoted in the source, puts it bluntly. The aesthetic is about owning the libs. It's designed to upset the overeducated regulators, the metropolitan liberal elite, almost to the point of aesthetic PTSD.
How does gold and scale achieve that?
For leaders, especially maybe those who fear being forgotten, the massive use of gold signals permanence, immortality almost. For those perhaps with fragile egos, the sheer overwhelming scale signals unquestionable power. This new ballroom, 90,000 square feet, costing over $300 million, isn't just seen as architecture. It's being read as a monument to the leader's personal hubris.
Isn't this maybe just a bit of aesthetic pearl-clutching? Does history actually offer warnings to leaders who go overboard renovating their official residences?
Oh, history is full of very clear, consistent warnings on this front. Leaders who engage in these kinds of excessive, highly personalized renovation projects very often end up inviting public ridicule and intense scrutiny of their spending and taste.
Like Louis XIV in Versailles.
Exactly. Turning a modest hunting lodge into the fiscally crippling, monumentally excessive Versailles. Or, much more recently, think of Jacob Zuma in South Africa, trying to justify his huge private swimming pool as merely a fire pool needed for safety.
Right, the fire pool.
Or remember the detailed inventories of excess found in the residence of Ukraine's former president, Viktor Yanukovych, after he fled. Gold toilet brushes, private golf courses, that stuff galvanized public outrage against him. These moments create what the source calls an inventory of excess that becomes symbolic of the leader's detachment and corruption. It often contributes to their downfall or lasting humiliation. So this new ballroom, even if it's entirely paid for by private donors as claimed, is already being judged by critics as a 90,000 square foot slab of political and architectural hubris.
Okay, from the White House to the movie theater, we seem to be in what's being called a golden age of horror films. Why are people apparently flocking to movies designed to make them faint, vomit, or have a heart attack, especially when the real world outside feels pretty stressful already?
It's a genuine commercial phenomenon. Horror movies now account for about one-fifth of the 20 highest-grossing films worldwide. They make up around 17% of the total U.S. box office take, which is way up from just 4% about a decade ago.
What revived the genre? It felt tired for a while.
The analysis credits its revitalization largely to two key moments back in the 90s. First, the clever, self-aware meta-horror of Scream. And second, the super low-budget but incredibly effective and profitable Blair Witch Project.
Right. Found footage took off.
Exactly. That led directly to the highly successful Blumhouse production model. Keep the budgets low, give filmmakers high creative freedom, aim for high returns. And that formula has actually attracted a lot of really first-rate acting and directing talent back into the horror genre.
Okay, so it's commercially successful, but what's the deeper psychological reason why people want to be scared right now? Is it just escapism?
It seems to be deeper than just escapism. It's more like catharsis. And it seems driven by underlying anxiety. You see, surveys showing that around 40% of people actively avoid watching the news because they find it too upsetting, too stressful.
So horror films offer a different kind of stress.
A controlled stress. Horror films provide this safe, contained environment where viewers can take all their free-floating daily dread anxiety about climate change, economic instability, political polarization, wars, and project it onto the screen. onto a specific monster or threat.
So it's a way of processing real-world fears.
Yeah, the argument is that people are drawn to these films partly to better understand the nature of the dangers they feel surrounding them,
right,
and maybe to practice a controlled emotional response. Think about how films about AI going rogue, like the M3GN franchise, tap into current anxieties, or how contagion fears drove renewed interest in that 2011 movie Contagion during the pandemic.
So the cinema lets you face the fear.
And process it within a neat fictional narrative that, crucially, has an ending, usually in about 90 minutes. The analysis uses a great metaphor. If zebras could watch movies about lions stalking their prey, they probably would, just to better understand the patterns of the threat they face every day.
That is a memorable metaphor. Okay, now let's look at a different kind of spectacle, the art of protest. We're seeing this interesting rise in the use of, well, silly costumes, like that inflatable frog menagerie seen at protests in Portland. What's that about?
This is actually a pretty sophisticated and deliberate protest strategy. It's sometimes called laughterism, or creating dilemma action.
Dilemma actions.
Yeah. The visual strategy relies entirely on making any attempt at enforcement by the authorities look heavy-handed, disproportionate, and, frankly, ridiculous.
How does a frog costume achieve that?
Well, imagine a police officer in full riot gear trying to arrest, or worse, pepper spray, someone dressed as a giant, harmless, inflatable frog, or trying to confiscate the frog's air vent. It immediately casts the authorities as the humorless stooges in the protesters' own street theater. It's incredibly effective visually, especially for social media.
So dressing up as cuddly animals undermines the official narrative.
Exactly. It directly rebuffs the common official line that protesters are dangerous terrorists or violent maniacs. It forces the authorities into a dilemma. If they use force against the silly costumes, they look aggressive and absurd. If they don't use force, they effectively concede the public space to the protesters. That strategic vulnerability, the protesters' willingness to look goofy, gets converted into a kind of political charisma.
And this connects to some of the most powerful, iconic images of resistance throughout history, doesn't it?
Absolutely. When you think about the protest images that really endure, they're rarely pictures of vast, anonymous crowds. They're usually images of a solitary figure or a small, clearly vulnerable group peacefully facing down immense institutional power.
Like the tank man in Tiananmen Square.
The classic example. The lone unarmed man blocking a column of tanks in Beijing. Or that harrowing photo of the high school student being attacked by a police dog in Alabama during the civil rights movement. Or the woman in the red dress being tear gassed by police in Istanbul's Gezi Park protests.
What makes those images so powerful?
They simplify the moral choice for the onlooker, don't they? Do you side with the serene, apparently peaceful individual, the student, the woman in the summer dress, or do you side with the heavily armed, visored robocops arresting or attacking them? It appeals directly to our ingrained human sense of fairness and proportionality.
Okay, our final cultural topic today deals with the slow, almost unnoticed decline of a tool that has profoundly shaped modern life, the questionnaire.
Yeah, it's a really interesting, like, kind of ironic observation about how we gather information about ourselves. Questionnaires, surveys, polls, they've been absolutely foundational to how we understand modern society. They're used to calculate GDP, to conduct all political polling, even to define norms around human sexuality and social behavior.
But they're in trouble now. Response rates are falling.
Falling off a cliff in some cases.
Yeah.
The UK labor force survey is a crucial one. Governments use it to help set interest rates, manage the economy. Its response rate used to be a healthy 70% back in the 1990s. Now, it's plummeted to just 20%.
20%? That's barely usable. What's causing this collapse?
It seems to be largely down to the internet, which created two key conditions. First, the internet completely eliminated the barrier to creating surveys. There's no gatekeepers anymore. Anyone can create a survey about anything.
Leading to survey fatigue.
Exactly. We are absolutely inundated with requests for feedback. Rate your customer service experience out of 10. Tell us how well your colleague ran that internal meeting. How was your Uber ride? It's constant.
Okay, fatigue. What's the second factor?
Second, and maybe more fundamentally, the internet has eliminated the social pressure to respond. You get an email asking you to fill out a survey. You can just delete it or close the browser tab. There's zero social consequence. That's very different from, say, trying to avoid making eye contact with a student holding a clipboard right in your path, or politely getting rid of a pollster who rings your doorbell. The social friction required to say no has basically disappeared online.
So it's ironic. Just as we have the technology to survey everything, people are tuning out.
It's deeply ironic. The analysis concludes by noting that people seem to be, perhaps unconsciously, finally taking the advice of the poet W.H. Auden. Auden was apparently repelled by the whole process of categorizing humanity after he had to survey bombed-out Germans back in 1945. His famous final piece of advice to society was, "Thou shalt not answer questionnaires." And now maybe society is finally accidentally taking him up on that.
A fascinating endpoint for that section. Okay, let's try and synthesize what we've covered. This has been an incredibly detailed look at a really volatile week across the globe.
It really has. And if you pull back, you see this recurring theme, don't you? Global leaders trying to strike these temporary, very transactional deals.
Like the U.S.-China truce, which was explicitly conditional and short-term.
Or the U.S. demanding these huge financial concessions from its Asian allies just to maintain the status quo security relationship.
And all this is happening while they're grappling with these really deep structural problems at home and internationally.
Exactly. You've got New York City struggling with its decaying fiscal model, this definancialization. You have Argentina taking this monumental gamble on austerity, which, incredibly, its voters seem to have endorsed for now.
And Europe being forced to confront its deep reliance on U.S. defense commitments and, increasingly, its own role in funding global aid, especially with Russia escalating the power war in Ukraine.
Yeah, instability seems to be the dominant theme, defined by these short-term political fixes trying desperately to patch over widening long-term structural cracks.
And the juxtaposition this week between incredible human effort in one sphere and devastating policy failure in another was particularly stark, wasn't it?
It really was.
We talked about that amazing medical miracle, the breakthrough that allowed Tim Andrews to survive for 271 days with a genetically modified pig kidney xenotransplant. A genuine marvel of advanced science. Huge financial resources poured into saving just one life.
And that leads us right into our final provocative thought for you, our listener, to take away from this deep dive.
That record-breaking, incredibly resource-intensive effort to save a single human life through a technological miracle
is happening at the exact same moment that a deliberate policy decision, the dismantling of America's global health aid programs, the proposed two-thirds cut to bilateral funding, is projected by expert analysts to passively condemn potentially up to 1 million African lives. Lives that could be lost to easily preventable and treatable diseases like HIV, TB, and malaria.
It really forces you to ask that essential structural question, doesn't it? When we marshal our vast resources, our financial capital, our political will, our scientific ingenuity, where do our moral priorities and maybe even our strategic priorities truly lie?
Why does the intense effort to achieve a technological record, saving one life, so often seem to eclipse the simpler, arguably more impactful commitment of just maintaining a basic, proven humanitarian lifeline for hundreds of thousands?
That's the structural challenge, the difficult question left for you, our listener, to reflect on this week.
A profound point to end on indeed. Thanks for joining us for the deep dive.
Thank you. We'll be back soon with more critical analysis.